This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. History is an imperfect instrument. No question, it's necessary. It's how we understand where we are now. But history often oversimplifies the past. Take, for example, the American Revolution. No less an authority than John Adams wrote that no history of the debates in revolutionary Philadelphia could possibly be accurate because so many of the critical conversations and decisions were conducted in the back rooms of taverns and never recorded. Then Adams went on to complain about the deification of America's revolutionary leaders, and in a new book, historian Joseph Ellis argues, along with Adams, that what history portrays as the product of great men and careful deliberation is in fact a product of chance, contingency, unintended consequences, and a leadership that improvised on the edge of catastrophe. Events, he writes, not men, were in the saddle. A bit later in the program, a journalist has himself waterboarded to spark discussion about what's torture and what isn't. But first, Joseph Ellis, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian at Mount Holyoke College. His new book is titled American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. He joins us today from the studios of Member Station in San Francisco, KQED. And Joseph Ellis, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Great to be back with you.
And I wanted to ask you about something, another one of the founding fathers you quote in the beginning of your book, George Washington, who argues that two of the greatest assets to the revolution, militarily, he said, highly improbable, a miraculous thing militarily, but there were two great assets, time and space, but didn't refer to either of those things in the sense that we would immediately think.
No, I think by time, Washington meant that the American Revolution was occurring in the wake of this outburst of new ideas called, it had yet to be called the Enlightenment, but new ways of thinking about human nature and about government that originate in France, England, and Scotland, so that the revolutionary generation has available to it a body of knowledge that describes a kind of political architecture. And so they don't have to invent it. All they've got to do is implement it, which is not easy to do. But that's what he's talking about with regard to time.
And another thing you mentioned is time, not necessarily describing this to Washington, though, that the American Revolution occurred at a moment of post-aristocracy and pre-democracy. Very important.
Yeah. Post-aristocracy means that in the American colonies, while it's hardly an egalitarian society, it is open to talent in a way that neither France nor England would be. France and England has an aristocracy, a blooded aristocracy, that only includes about 5% of the population. And a person like Alexander Hamilton, who was literally a bastard, would never have succeeded. Franklin would have remained a bookseller. George Washington would have remained a major in the British Army. So there's a level of openness available in an American society that's not yet available in Europe, and it's pre-democratic. Sometimes people won't like to hear that, but none of the founders thought they were setting up a democracy. A democracy to them was a epithet. It meant mob rule or pandering to popular opinion. They were a self-conscious elite, to be sure, a meritocracy, a natural aristocracy, but they considered themselves an elite that was not worshiping the people. The people, said Hamilton, the people, sir, is a great beast. But rather they were serving the public, res publica, republic. And the public is the long-term interest of the people, which at any given time the people probably doesn't fathom.
And space was the other one of Washington's great assets. And you look immediately and say, of course, the Atlantic Ocean was a tremendous asset.
It was, and he said that on other occasions. But the specific quote I use here is talking about the incredible land to the west, the fact that we're splendidly isolated from Europe, which is huge. I mean, if we were in the middle of Europe like Poland, we wouldn't have been able to succeed. But we have this, if you will, this trust fund, which is this unbelievably bountiful plot of land. Now, it's not entirely unoccupied. There are about 80,000 Native Americans living between the Alleghenies and the Mississippi. But Washington senses that America's future is to the west. And when Lafayette asks him after the war if he wants to take a grand tour of Europe, because he's a great hero throughout the world, and come and visit Berlin and Vienna and Rome, and Washington says, no, you come on over here and we'll go to New York and to Detroit and to New Orleans and Savannah. And those are the real capitals of the future.
Interesting, too. You define the founding period in America as basically between the adoption of the Declaration of Independence and the Louisiana Purchase. Why so much later than many would take it?
Yeah, some people would end it in 1800 because it has a nice chronological serenity about it. But I say 1803 because I think that the acquisition of that huge plot of land between the Mississippi and the Rocky Mountains for the pittance of $15 million virtually assures that this is going to be a continental republic. This is where America's destiny truly becomes manifest, and that the acquisition of this land extends the republic to the west in a way that is eventually going to reach the Pacific. It's also, however, the last time, I think, when the founders have some plausible chance of trying to end the slavery stigma. And if they had decided to prohibit the expansion of slavery into the states coming in from Louisiana Territory, and also use some of the revenue from the land sales to compensate owners, I think that's the last chance we had to avoid the Civil War, but we miss it.
Yes, and indeed, one of the things you write about, the genius of the system that they set up, not entirely by design, but by happenstance and argument and compromise, but nevertheless, the genius was that there were countervailing centers, no one authority. One authority had always been the case in every case in the past.
You're right, Neil. From the time of Aristotle, it was assumed that there had to be a singular source of sovereignty in the body politic. There had to be a final place where all ultimate questions could be resolved. This is actually what gets the British into such trouble with the colonies and brings on the American Revolution, because the British feel that Parliament must be the sovereign source to rule for the empire, not the local or colonial assemblies. What the founders decide to do in a kind of willy-nilly way is to say that there are multiple sovereignties. Within the government, no branch is absolutely sovereign. Each has power, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. But you can't say that any one of them is completely sovereign. And by the same token, the biggest question at issue in the Constitutional Convention and the ratifying conventions and up through the 90s is, where does sovereignty lie between the federal government and the states? Now, to some extent, that's still very much an issue, but what the founders decide to do is not to answer the question, but to set up an argumentative framework where the debate continues to go on a case-by-case basis. So that it's interesting when somebody like Judge Scalia or Thomas talks about recovering original intent. If I'm right, the real original intent is not to provide a specific jurisprudence answer, but to provide an environment in which the debate can continue into the present.
We're talking with Joseph Ellis about his new book. This is called American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. If you'd like to talk with him, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can also read what other listeners have to say on our blog. That's at npr.org/blog of the nation. And let's begin with Daniel. Daniel with us from Rice Lake in Wisconsin.
Hello.
Hi.
I've often thought a liberal person now would have been liberal then, and conversely, a conservative now would have been conservative then. Conservatives are not revolutionaries. Would you characterize the revolutionaries as ultra-liberals?
No. I would categorize most of them as conservative revolutionaries, cautious, prudent revolutionaries.
It almost sounds like a contradiction in terms.
It is a contradiction in terms, and that's what makes them so unusual. I mean, I think that they're prepared to take the revolutionary act of breaking with Great Britain, which is a very risky act. When Washington leaves Mount Vernon in 1775, he says to his custodian there, when the British come to burn Mount Vernon, get my books and Martha out, not necessarily in that order. And they really are risking their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. On the other hand, they are all, or most of them, there are some exceptions like Tom Paine, very evolutionary in their implementation of a radical agenda. That is to say, the implications of the Declaration of Independence call for women's right to vote, for the abolition of a property qualification, bunches of other liberal reforms. They say we must not attempt to implement them suddenly and immediately, as they will eventually try to do in the French Revolution, because then the revolution will implode and we'll have nothing. So that they're a cautious group of revolutionaries. And that's one of the reasons that it succeeds. That we talked before about pace and about space. Well, they also control pace in a way that allows for this to be a successful revolution.
Indeed, you talk about how those 55 first great words in the Declaration of Independence, well, they sort of snuck in without John Adams noticing it so much.
You mean the ones that begin, "We hold these truths to be self-evident"?
The ones we all like, yeah.
Yeah, those are, they're really not the first words, Neil, but they're the second paragraph, I believe.
Okay.
But they are the magic words of American history. And in some sense, what happens is that those words aren't, nobody pays much attention to those words during the debate over them on July 2nd and 3rd. They all are focused on the last two-thirds of the document with a long indictment against George III because they think that's what they need to get right. They think of that 55-word paragraph as a kind of rhetorical flourish. Well, those turn out to be the single most important 55 words in American history and maybe in modern history because they basically contain the liberal promise. And they are the mandate for all of the reforms that will go forward, the end of slavery. Remember when Lincoln at Gettysburg says 77 years ago,
mm-hmm.
that refers back to 1776. And when Martin Luther King is on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial giving the I Have a Dream speech, he says that Mr. Jefferson wrote a promissory note that I'm cashing in right now for the civil rights movement. And when the Massachusetts Supreme Court issues its ruling on gay marriage, it too refers back to the same language.
We're talking with Joseph Ellis. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. What are the moments of creativity and tragedy in the American Foundation? I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Joseph Ellis about the sometimes messy story of how the United States was formed. His new book is titled American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Foundation of the Republic. You're also invited to join us if you want to talk with Joseph Ellis, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can find an excerpt from the book and read about the strangest and most consequential year in American history at npr.org/talk. And Joseph Ellis, one of the things you do in the book is tell stories about unlikely moments, as we might think of them if we remember our regular histories of the American Revolution. And one of them, the moment of Valley Forge. You describe it as the American Gethsemane, the terrible suffering that under the people, the troops underwent at Valley Forge, and how true that is, yet how it overlooks two really vital decisions that formed not just the future of the revolution, but the future of the American country.
Help me figure out what I said there, Neil. I know one of them anyway. It's really true that it was horrible at Valley Forge. It was a very cold winter. They were starving to death. About 2,000 of 12,000 soldiers died of exposure or malnutrition. There was really blood on the snow from their bare feet trickling blood. One of the things that happened is that George Washington, during the Valley Forge encampment, came to the realization that if the American War for Independence remained a contest between armies, that he, Washington, was likely to lose because in the end, the Continental Army could not compete against the superior professional force of the British Army and Navy. States were also backing off their commitment to money and men. And the war had to change character, and it's in the Valley Forge winter that Washington, with an assist from his able lieutenant Nathaniel Greene, comes up with a somewhat different strategy. If you will, this might be a little controversial, Washington comes to realize that he's leading an insurgency, not just an army. And in some sense, he comes to the realization that the British have a predicament, which is quite analogous to the predicament that the United States currently has in Iraq. Namely, They can win all the battles. They can take all the cities, and they do. They take Boston. They take New York. They take Philadelphia. They take Charleston. But they cannot subjugate the population. The land, there's too much area to occupy, and it's too what they call peopled. And that in some sense, the only way Washington can lose the war is if he tries to win it and has the Continental Army annihilated. So he fights what they call a war of posts or a Fabian defensive strategy for the rest of the war. And maybe this is the second thing. He arranges the Continental Army in a kind of arc going up from southern New Jersey all the way up through New York and around to the Connecticut Hills to control the countryside. The hearts and minds of Americans are what really is at stake at this moment. And at that point in time, Washington comes to understand that if he successfully avoids defeat, eventually the British, they won't be defeated. They'll simply give up.
Which is, in fact, what happens. Nevertheless, the other second thing that you said was...
Remind me.
he needed to disabuse Congress of the notion that patriotic militia could defeat trained British troops, that he needed, in fact, to train the lines of Continental soldiers, regular soldiers, which is almost diametrical to the ideals of the Republic.
That's right. In order to win the war and have the Republican ideals live on... You had to create a standing army, which violates the principles of the Republic. But Washington said that's the way it is. He never got all the troops he wanted. He wanted almost 40,000 troops. He never got more than 12,000. And the Continental Army is a kind of permanent turnstile or accordion. People are coming and going all the time. There's only a group of about 4,000 to 5,000 of people who serve for the duration. Those are the real heroes of the war. And not enough attention has been paid to them. They're not your typical Americans. They're indentured servants. They're ex-slaves. At any given time, the Continental Army is 6 to 12% African American, and they're in integrated units. It's the only time. And the next time you'll have integrated units in the Army is in Korea. And those people are the core of the core. They never got their pensions. They never got their pay. They were starving to death. They're the ones huddled in those huts at Valley Forge. And that story is an incredibly great story that some great movie maker needs to tell.
Let's see if we get some more callers on the line. Again, our guest is Joseph Ellis. We're talking about his new book, American Creation. Let's go to Vince. Vince with us from Chico in California.
Hi.
Hi there.
My question is about James Madison in Virginia. My impression was that James Madison had a very well thought out separation of powers between the judicial and legislative that he tried to put in effect in Virginia, but couldn't get it past the governor, Patrick Henry, so that he brought this to the Continental Congress, when he could make it, that is, and they have a large part of his ideas from the Virginia plan were crafted into the Constitution. And it wasn't so much that it was a majority of his plan. Is my impression mistaken?
No, you're right. I think the issue you mentioned first is in Virginia, he's campaigning for a separation of church and state. He and Jefferson, who's in Paris by this time, wrote this, and they're very, very proud of it. And you're right, Patrick Henry blocked it. The Constitution never mentions God. They asked Hamilton later on, you know, how come it doesn't mention God? And Hamilton said, "Why, sir, the matter never came up." He also says that there was once a moment when Franklin, of all people, asked if they could bring in a chaplain to say a prayer because they were having a very difficult debate. And Hamilton said, "I see no reason to call in foreign aid." I think that Madison is the father of the Constitution, and he's the one who, in conjunction with other members of the Virginia delegation that included Washington, set the agenda for the Constitutional Convention, making sure that it became a debate about the fundamental root and branch reform of the Articles and not just a modest revision. But Madison wanted a very clear resolution that the federal government was sovereign. He wanted the federal government to have a veto over all state legislation, and
right.
He could never get that accepted. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons when he left the Constitutional Convention, he thought it was a failure. By not providing a clear resolution, of the sovereignty issue, he thought that eventually we would degenerate into a series of separate confederacies. Turns out, and he eventually realizes this, the fact that he failed was lucky because it created this argumentative context which continues to define the meaning of the Constitution. And Madison shifts positions in the 90s. He's an elusive guy. Once he realizes that the state of Virginia is not going to be well served by a sovereign, commercially oriented federal government, he switches to a states' rights position.
And part of that may have been to do with Patrick Henry's power over his views, perhaps.
Well, he basically argued the one of the great debates in American history is the debate in the Virginia Ratifying Convention in June of 1788, and the two great debaters are James Madison and Patrick Henry. And Patrick Henry is calling for a vote against the Constitution, and Madison's obviously calling for a vote for. But all the arguments that Henry makes against the Constitution, Madison, 2 years later, adopts them all as his own. So that, you know, like when you say original intent with Madison, it's like what time in Madison's career are you talking about? He switches sides.
Thanks for the call, Vince.
Thank you.
So long. Let's see if we can go now to Jim. Jim's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Yes, I was wanting to ask your guests, you know, I'm a teacher myself, and I was just wanting to know what you think about the modern high school today and how it kind of de-emphasizes the sacrifices that the Founding Fathers made. And it's disappointing to see that history and civics are going down this road. I myself emphasize the point that many of our Founding Fathers suffered horribly. You know, they were men of wealth. They didn't necessarily have to sacrifice anything. And I was just wanting to know your opinion on that.
Well, the world of secondary school high school teaching is a pretty diverse thing, and it depends on where you are. I've been impressed with the number of secondary high school teachers that are assigning books that I write. I mean, like Founding Brothers is assigned in a lot of honors classes in secondary schools. And I think that the very fact that 11 books in the last decade that have focused on the founding era have made it to the New York Times bestseller list has suggested that there is a constituency out there that is interested in serious history and the recovery, at least of that particularly propitious moment. I do think you're right that a lot of the academic world that produces the textbooks are focusing on things they call social history, which is the history of the ordinary, now rather than the extraordinary, of the peripheral rather than the center. They don't want to do politics. Now, I say if you don't want to do politics and you want to study the late 18th century, well, that's like showing up at Fenway Park with a lacrosse stick. But I think there is a real audience for this material that is clearly being it's expressing itself in the way it's purchasing books.
There most certainly is. And from my standpoint, along with my colleagues in my school in specific, we do emphasize and we do concentrate on the fact that the Founding Fathers did make great sacrifices to bring our country to this point. Now, it may not have been intentioned that way, but it is the way that it turned out. And we owe a great deal of gratitude and respect for those men for what they did.
Yet, Joseph Ellis, you also point out that we should not deify these men.
That's right. Exactly.
They all made a lot of mistakes.
We're all together on this one. It's a flawed greatness, but it is greatness. It's true greatness. What they achieved sets the model for the liberal nation state in the modern world. That's a big deal. But they are all flawed creatures, and they did make some blunders. Now, whether ending slavery was possible, whether solving the Native American problem was at all possible or plausible, is an interesting argument to have, and I try to write about that in this current book. Mm-hmm. But what we want to avoid is a kind of swoonish swing between either celebration of a mindless sort or evisceration. These are the deadest, whitest males in American history that have given us racism, imperialism, patriarchy, and all the evil things of the world.
Genocide. Don't forget
genocide. Yeah, genocide. Can't forget that. But, I mean, that's an adolescent interpretation. It's a juvenile interpretation.
Certainly, and I think the point to be emphasized, especially with a secondary teacher, is that they were men nonetheless, and with all the inherent weaknesses that men possess.
There's an interesting point in the book. Joseph Ellis notes that one of the reasons John Adams so strongly opposed the deification of American revolutionaries was his fear that he would not be counted among the top two or three.
That's right. If he wasn't going to make the top tier, he was going to destroy everybody else in the process. And he was a vain guy, but he's lovable. Whenever they ask me, who would I like to have a beer with, that's the one I pick, John Adams. Maybe we could have a Sam Adams beer together, you know? Because he'll tell you the truth. He'll tell you what's really going on in his head and in his soul.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate that, Jim. We're talking with Joseph Ellis. His new book is American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies in the Founding of the Republic. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we get Patrick on the line. Patrick's calling us from Berkeley, California.
Hi.
I'm right near you, Patrick. I'm in San Francisco.
Oh, good. Well, I'll just get over the bridge and we'll finish this up. I've enjoyed one of your books at least, but I'm in the process of reading a book on the settlement of the Ohio River Valley that runs from 1820 to the 1720 up until later. And there are a couple of points in there that I thought were interesting in, on your topic. And one is a letter from Thomas Jefferson to the Indiana Territory governor setting out a plan for having forts that would sell goods to the Indians, get them in so much debt that their right. only option is to transfer the lands, and if they decide not to accept this approach, then take up a hatchet. Well, then we'll just push them over the Mississippi.
And then it's a famous letter. It's a famous letter. It's pretty grisly.
And then there's another one by Washington to Congress that sets up another strategy a little earlier about how to flood the territory with people, kill all the animals, and then they'll want to sell. They'll be as eager to sell as we are to buy, he says. And then he sets out a more detailed strategy. And I guess the question I have is, you know, recognizing back at that time, it's very easy to say, oh, well, in those times, that was the only way to do it, two different concepts of property, and that's how to. But we face this today as well in other locales and other properties, not ourselves necessarily, but others. And we talk about a liberal government, enlightened, et cetera, but other places are repeating the same. Is there another way, or was there another way to actually accomplish this and accommodate those two different concepts of property and livelihood?
I got a chapter on this that you will find interesting, I hope. You're right that Washington did, at one point in the 1780s, endorse what we might call the demographic strategy, the expansion of the white population to the West and just gradually pushing the Native American tribes further west, signing treaties, knowing that all those treaties were really going to eventually be broken. But when he came into power as president, in part because of the influence of his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, Washington came to realize that he had a moral obligation to do as much as he could to avoid Indian removal, that the Native Americans had a legitimate right to the land and that it could not be taken away from them without their consent, and that that was the legacy of the revolution that he had fought and wrought, and that he made that a major priority in his first term. The strategy that he adopted was, the model strategy was signed in New York in 1790 with the Creek Nation. They had 27 Creek chiefs there, spending a month there celebrating and getting drunk every night. And it would set up a series of enclaves east of the Mississippi, which would be under the control of the Native American tribes, maybe two in the south and two north of the Ohio, that would be bypassed by the white population because it would be guaranteed as sovereign states, just as sovereign as, say, France. And the pledge of the executive branch of the federal government was made to honor those treaties. The problem was they were unenforceable. There were 500,000 whites west of the Alleghenies by 1800. In order to prevent them from moving into these homeland territories, you would have needed an army of at least 50,000 troops. And the size of the army at that time was like 2,000. It was unenforceable. Washington said it would take a Chinese wall to prevent this from happening. And it was, to some extent, he regarded the failure to reach a just solution with the Native Americans as the biggest failure of his presidency.
Thanks very much for the call, Patrick.
Thank you.
We'll continue our talk with Joseph Ellis about the creation of America in just a moment, plus with all the debate about what's torture and what isn't, we'll get a first-hand account of what it feels like to be waterboarded. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking with Joseph Ellis about his new book. It's called American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line with us. And this is going to be Steve. Steve with us from Grand Rapids in Michigan.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing
today? I'm well today. Thank you.
I wanted to bring up the topic of every time there's a debate about church and state, it seems the religious side always says that the original founding fathers always intended America to be a Christian society and based on Christian laws. And I wondered what your guest had to say about that.
I've encountered a lot of that, especially if you go on to the book tour and have call-ins, and there are an awful lot of people, evangelical Christians, who feel very strongly about that. And when I was writing this book, I had my guy fixing my heat pump in my house, and he saw all these books out, and he says, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing a book about the founders." And he said, "Well, you just make sure you tell everybody that all those guys were Christians, and they intended to set up a Christian nation." I think that's not true. I think that the most of the founders were Christians in some sense of the term, lukewarm Episcopalians. Jefferson was a kind of a deist, really. Although he said that in 50 years, everybody in America was going to be a Unitarian. I think that one of the achievements of the founding is to set up the first secular state, the separation of church and state. And Jefferson liked the phrase of Diderot. He said, "I want to see the last king strangled with the entrails of the last priest." The word creator is used in the Declaration, but God is not used, and nor is it used, as we said earlier, in the Constitution. I think that one of their major achievements, and gosh knows, looking at the situation in the Middle East, you can see how difficult it is even now for many areas of the world, is to say that it is not essential that the glue that brings a community together be a sort of religious or theological set of principles. That you don't need to have a common religious experience, that you can have a diverse diversified religious group. It can be different kind of Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. While there are in certain states, Massachusetts and Virginia, state-supported religious establishments up till about 1815 to 1820, at the federal level, separation of church and state is what they meant, and they meant it literally, so that I just don't think it's proper to see these people as modern-day Christian evangelicals.
Thanks very much for the call, Steve.
Thank you.
And I wanted to wrap up with you, Joseph Ellis, by asking about what some consider the great moral lapse of the Revolution. And this is one of your fundamental themes in your book, the idea that the fruits of the Revolution were not to be extended to the mass of the population during the time of war, indeed to African Americans, to American Indians, or to women, for that matter. These decisions were all deliberately postponed.
That's right. I mean, you know, and again, you know, you can really be accused of perversity here, but in some sense, the fact that they controlled the pace of revolutionary change was one of the reasons why they were successful. And there's no question that if they tried to implement, if they tried to end slavery in the 1770s or 80s, Georgia and South Carolina and probably Virginia would have seceded from the Union. It's a tricky situation here, and you know, for those who believe that justice delayed is justice denied, then what they did is wrong. But I'm adopting a more Burkean conservative view and saying that that I think that there was real wisdom here in the delay of some of these. I think that slavery is the exception, because I think if they had been able to act on slavery before the end of the 18th or into the early 19th century, there was a shot at ending it in a gradual way. And once that was missed, then we were going to head towards the Civil War. But this is the kind of thing that I hope my book will provoke discussion about. If, in fact, the framers set up an argumentative context for American political culture, I'd like my book to be a thing that people can argue about as well.
Joseph Ellis, thanks very much. It's been fun talking with you, and I'll try arguing next time you're on.
Thank you for having me again.
Joseph Ellis's new book is American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic, with us today from our member station in San Francisco, KQED. What it feels like to be waterboarded, next.